Hi, this is Dr. Mike Chupp, and you are listening to CMDA Matters, the weekly podcast of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. Well, it's a new year, and I hope you just enjoyed our new theme music for 2023. Today, before I introduce our guest, I just wanted to take a few minutes to say thank you for giving so generously in November and December. In December, I shared that this was a challenging season for CMDA. We actually had to make some tough decisions to get us back on track financially, and we needed to meet our year-end giving target of $655,000. I'm thrilled to let you know, friends, that we have exceeded this goal through the generosity of many, including many of you listening right now. We still have a few more gifts arriving and being accounted for, so I look forward to sharing our final results of your generosity very soon on this program. Solomon says in Proverbs 11:25, "The generous will prosper. Those who refresh others will themselves be refreshed." Thank you, friends, for refreshing us with your prayers, your words of encouragement, and this generosity. Our prayers are that you, too, will be refreshed now in early 2023. Well, our guest this week is Dr. Andre Van Maal, whose voice you've heard previously on CMDA Matters. He joined me recently to talk about the latest news coming out of the transgender debate. And I have to say, he is one of the premier voices in healthcare on sexual orientation and gender identity issues. There's been some major developments on this topic just in the last year or so, including the closure of a major gender clinic in the United Kingdom. Let's jump right in to my conversation today with Dr. Andre Van Maal. Well, today on CMDA Matters, I have a repeat guest, someone that I hear from several times every week by email, who is a prolific reader and speaker on the topic of transgenderism, gender identity, gender dysphoria, and that's Dr. Andre Van Maal. He's a board-certified family physician in full-time practice in California. He co-chairs our CMDA Sexual and Gender Identity Task Force, and he works closely also with the American College of Pediatricians Council on Adolescent Sexuality. He's been working with our friends over at Alliance Defending Freedom in a coalition of professionals who are advising on policy matters addressing sexual orientation as well as gender identity. Dr. Van Maal serves on the boards of Bethel Church in California, and he and his wife, Evelyn, are both former U.S. Naval officers. They've got two sons and two daughters, the latter of whom were among their nine foster children. Andre, it is a privilege. Thank you for joining us again today on CMDA Matters.
Thank you for having me on, Mike.
Andre, I don't know of anyone, honestly, in our country who's more heavily involved in the battle against transgender ideology. I don't know anyone who's invested more time, energy in this battle for truth to win than you. Our transgender ideologues on the other side of this issue have leveraged the very real psychiatric disorder known as gender dysphoria and turned it into what could be called a transgender tornado with a wake of destroyed lives and families. And the battle seems to be primarily being fought in Europe and in the U.S., and you just happen to have returned from a journey to Brussels, where you gave testimony and got introduced to a number of members of parliament. Tell us what that testimony and experience was like there in Brussels this last week.
Yeah, I just got back from that recently. We are told it was the first of its kind conference to present against gender, really transition, affirming medical interventions in minors. We were invited by a German member of the European Parliament. It was a small conference, but we're told all such conferences in the European Parliament are small, but it was also simulcast on social media. So speaking there were myself, psychologist Laura Haynes from our CMDA Gender and Sexual Identity Task Force, Quentin Van Meter of ACPEDS, Walt Heyer, probably well known to our listeners here, piped in by video, as did child psychologist Jeff Hansen. As you were saying, I did get to meet numerous members of parliament who are on board with this, but, you know, looking for more information. Basically, the German MEP who, you know, as I say, invited us to the dance, she and her staff considered the conference to be a radical success. Again, a lot of other contacts made and other information, you know, exchanged aside from the conference. relationships forged, and they anticipate, you know, future interaction with us. So a success all the way around.
So we've been celebrating in 2022 a number of things that have happened, monumental changes that have been followed around the world, whether it's in the United Kingdom or in Sweden, in Australia, but specifically the Tavistock clinic situation and the National Health Service guidelines that have come out. Hilary Cass, I believe, I don't remember what her position was, but certainly a leading pediatrician from the past in the UK, and some guidelines that have come out from a task force, an investigation. So do you feel like many of these European public policy health authorities are truly in the direction of backing off on aggressive affirmation and being more cautious and in some ways a lot more scientific than we are here in the U.S.?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, one of the things I tell people when I talk to them is, you know, we in the U.S., Canada, and Australia are driving the train over the cliff, where nations like the U.K., Sweden, Finland, and now France, that were full swing, you know, pro-gender transition affirming care for minors, are doing a 180, and they did it based, you know, straight on the science. I mean, nobody can look at the UK, Sweden, and Finland and say, oh, it's the religious conservatives doing this, you know, too low of a percentage of the population. And to this, we also need to add the state of Florida, what they've done both in their Medicaid division, now passing the rule that no manner of gender / transition affirming therapy will be allowed for minors in the case of Medicaid, not minors or adults. And in the case of the Florida Board of Medicine, in deciding to ban both hormonal and surgical procedures for gender dysphoric.
And that was the first of its kind, was it not? I was actually in Florida in September and had an opportunity to share that with some of the Florida physicians in the crowd, pediatricians, that their state board was taking a look at this. Have any other state boards taken a look like Florida?
Florida is leading the pack by far. Now, you know, truth in advertising, I was involved as a consultant and remain so with the state of Florida on this thing. But the way it was done was with a keen focus persisting on specifically what the question and the legalities were, as well as the scientific track record, and coming up with supporting documents that would be the kind of thing useful for other states and other countries. And so far, it's held up in its first court challenge. Backtracking a bit, if I may say, about the UK, Sweden, Finland, as well as Florida, all four did comprehensive literature reviews. I believe the most extensive was done by the UK, their National Institute for Healthcare Excellence, which goes by the acronym NICE, doing a review on gonadotropin-releasing hormone agonists. So we call that the NICE 1, and the other one on gender-affirming hormones, NICE 2. And they, like the Swedes, like the Finns, when actually analyzing all of the data, came away saying, you know, all of these recommendations are based on low to usually very low quality data. We shouldn't be doing this to kids. You know, we should be doubling down on mental health assistance, mental health evaluation, and support for both the child and the parents' guardians, because we are sure to find issues in both. And that's not the way things are being presented in the U.S. and Canada, or for that matter, Australia, where, you know, they really want it to be transition on demand. You affirm or else. But we see that falling down in court in the U.S. now, too, courtesy of two different circuit courts, as you were alluding to earlier.
Have you seen any impact of that change upon U.S. practices anywhere? Maybe we're talking about Florida, so there's maybe a
right
change there, but anywhere else, or does it continue?
The answer to your question is yes. I mean, yes, the state of Florida is certainly leading the pack and to a degree leading the world there, but over 20 states have passed and more are working on. And again, Truth in Advertising, I'm helping a few with this, as are some of our other CMDA members, on SAFE Acts, which is an acronym for Save Adolescents from Experimentation. Particularly helpful thing in some of those SAFE Acts is trying to open wider the window for malpractice litigation. Once that's achieved, I think the malpractice attorneys are just going to drive a train through this thing. And the malpractice suits are now being filed, one or two of which I'm involved in and I can't really discuss, but we're hoping that these will be the American equivalent to the Bell versus Tavistock suit in the UK, and that it will really, you know, help crack this thing open. We've also noticed several university children's hospitals have made public statements that they will no longer be doing transition-affirming surgeries on minors. which, you know, on the one hand is also a clear admission that they were doing what so many of them said they weren't. You know, you don't say, hey, we won't be doing this anymore unless you were doing it in the first place. But change is afoot. Of course, you know, by the same token, opposition is going crazy, but that's fine because it gives us an opportunity to knock down their best arguments and their chief supposed sources of information.
So one of the current controversies, Andre, that I've been reading about and some things that you've recently sent to me, written by Leo Sapir, I believe, is how you pronounce his name, and that there's an argument that U.S. gender identity proponents, affirmation proponents, are following the Dutch protocol. And yet there's pushback from your camp that that's not true at all. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, it's false on multiple levels. For one, most directly, the so-called Dutch protocol excludes anybody with mental health problems. You know, it screens out for those supposedly extensively, wants those dealt with first before anybody can be put on the pathway of gender-affirming medical interventions, which is why it was usually such a small percentage of those presenting with gender dysphoria who actually qualified for it. Now, the people in the U.S. are saying, oh, we're following the Dutch protocol, and it's, you know, affirmation on demand and specifically being offered as something that treats gender dysphoria and reduces suicidality. Well, it does neither. And to claim you're following the Dutch protocol as a means of treating the very people that the Dutch protocol excluded, you know, as a matter of fact, it's double talk. And that was picked up on in testimony in Florida in one of the challenge court cases that has been won, even though other ones are underway.
Could you tell our listeners maybe just two or three studies that you think are just rock solid that provide the best medical evidence against engaging in changing, especially in children and adolescents, secondary sexual characteristics in patients with gender dysphoria?
One of the best of its kind, the 2011 Swedish study, author Denjen, I don't know if that's the way you pronounce D-H-E-J-N-E, but it is, of all 324 sex reassignment surgery patients over a 30-year period, you follow them 10 years out, 10 years, not 6 months, 1 year, 2 year, get past the honeymoon period, and you find 19 times the completed suicide rate, three times the rate of all-cause mortality, about three times the psych hospitalization. 2019, that was the online release, 2020 for the print, the Brandstrom and Pachanka study, claiming to be the first of its kind total population study of 9.7 million Swedes, you know, of course, looking at electronic medical records, that ultimately showed neither gender-affirming hormone treatment nor gender-affirming surgery. And the reason I'm using different references, you know, the first Denny study has said sex reassignment surgery and the other has said gender affirming surgery is because that is how the authors themselves referred to
it.
But again, Brandstrom and Pachankas ultimately showing neither gender affirming hormones nor gender affirming surgery provided a reduction of any of the mental health treatment benchmarks they examined. I would say just about anything by Professor Michael Biggs of Oxford. But the second paper he released this year, 2022, on the Dutch protocol, titled The Dutch Protocol for Juvenile Transsexuals, Origins and Evidence. And that is a real expose and takedown of the whole shooting match there. And again, though I'm repeating myself, listeners should be familiar with the comprehensive literature reviews done by the UK, Sweden, Finland, and Florida. The UK, again, that was the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, goes by the acronym NICE. The one for gonadotropin-releasing hormone agonists, the other for gender-affirming hormones. That's the number one. Next, out of Sweden, the Swedish Agency for Health Technology Assessment and Assessment of Social Services, their 2019 comprehensive literature review. And part of the Florida Medicaid rules was producing, as Florida requires, a GAPMS report, Generally Accepted Professional Medical Standards. It came out at about 233 pages. Just under 50 is the main report. That seems to be what's passed around. But the larger full report included a comprehensive literature review over about a two-year period done by some professionals out of McMaster University in Canada. And they were, as we say, agnostic on the subject, had no opinion one way or the other. They just did the literature review. And so these are all publicly available documents. So it makes review, you know, rather easy to see, again, that the professional literature in support of any kind of gender-affirming medical intervention, especially in minors, is a very low quality evidence. It's not sufficient to allow us to recommend these things.
The so-called Dutch protocol, was it most of their demographics are in adults, or was a significant subset of their population adolescents, children?
Yeah, Mike, regarding the Dutch protocol, what we're generally talking about there is an article that appeared in the Journal of Homosexuality in 2012. It was by authors De Vries and Cohen Ketness, who are well known in the field. And the title of the article answers the question of who was involved, and it's called Clinical Management of Gender Dysphoria in Children and Adolescents, the Dutch Approach. And that's what we're talking about when we say the Dutch protocol. There was an additional study besides this one that was involved with time, but this is the main one they're talking about. So yeah, it was just children and adolescents.
As you're talking to lawmakers, public policy influencers, whether here or in Europe or abroad, do you find that it makes more sense that you attack the basic premises and the outcome of this Dutch protocol versus trying to point out in the U.S. we're just far more aggressive, and even the people in Europe say that the U.S. is just too far gone, too far aggressive, and that gender identity clinics are not really following the Dutch protocol? Do you think you're using your time wisely, I guess is what I'm getting at, in arguing that the U.S. and Europe are different in their application, or is it best to go for the jugular and talk about the data out of the Dutch protocol and others?
The only time I even bring up the Dutch protocol is if the other side is using it, you know, making the claim that, oh, we're following the Dutch protocol and everything's great and wonderful. And that was the case, you know, in Florida, hearings on it. And at my request, I was not a part of the hearings. The reason here is very straightforward. It doesn't matter how much I know and how well I write it. The other side, I know, will lock into the fact that I'm a family physician and try to get my testimony disqualified. Whereas if we have pediatric endocrinologists, child adolescent psychologists or psychiatrists, plastic surgeons, and say a few detransitioners, their testimony becomes rather unassailable. But, you know, on the back door of this, I am providing information like to the legal teams, the state agencies that might be involved. And I just find that works a lot better. So the direct answer to your question is we address the Dutch protocol when it is brought up by the other side. Otherwise, you know, we go for the jugular by going with the main and plain, which is that gender dysphoria is a diagnosis, whereas transgenderism is an ideology, that the natural history of gender dysphoria is desistance by adulthood, unless you interfere by affirming it, and it is interference, that there is the overwhelming probability of underlying mental health problems, adverse childhood events, family dynamic problems, and neurodevelopmental problems, by which we mean, of course, autism spectrum, and that those are what need to be dealt with, and that the reality of the probability of desistance and of these underlying issues is the reason the standard of care has been watchful waiting with intensive psychological evaluation of the patient and family, because that usually takes care of it, you know, in the grand majority of the instances. Then, you know, bringing up the suicide reduction myth and dealing with that, because the other side always goes for it. Mm-hmm. And then if they go for, you know, the appeals to eminence as opposed to evidence-based science, by which I mean, well, this organization says it's great and that organization says it's great, then we go for the organization, be that WPATH, which is kind of easy to go after, or the American Academy of Pediatrics, whose pro-transition statement is by far the most radical in the U.S., and we know we're hitting the right chords because they react when we do that. But their reactions usually just provide an opportunity to address more bad studies that they'll bring up thinking that they're ironclad. So, you know, we allow them to sink their own ship.
2022 was a pretty doggone good year in terms
yes.
of court cases, in terms of what we talked about in the UK with the NHS and the closing of Tavistock and a relook there. Our listeners should know that it wasn't just in the Fifth Circuit where our efforts at CMDA with the help of Beckett and the Franciscan Alliance, 6 years in court and finally a final result of a permanent injunction against the 2016 transgender mandate that came out during the Obama administration. And then in the Eighth Circuit Court, just here in the last week or so, another decision is very similar to that, and also with Beckett and the same our same friend over there, our attorney Luke Goodrich was also involved there. What am I leaving out? Other things that happened in 2022, Andre, that are encouraging to you? Lots of TV specials. I've seen you in so many videos talking about these issues and about the science.
Yeah, the information's getting out there. Again, the thing with Florida and multiple states trying to pass SAFE Acts. These high court decisions are a big help. And now that the right kind of malpractice cases are starting to be filed, what I'm hoping to see is that the social contagion now will no longer be transition, but will be, you know, getting justice for the damage that was done to these formerly able-bodied young people who now have to live with chemical sterilization and surgical mutilation, again, of what was their healthy bodies.
I've heard our friend over at the Colson Center for Worldview, their president, John Stone Street, use the phrase inevitability hypothesis, and that we are subject to it so frequently as those of faith in healthcare and maybe other sectors in our culture, but that there's been this inevitability that we're just not going to be able to stop this transgender movement, but that it's not inevitable.
Yeah, quite right. And, you know, again, we're the CMDA, and what we're doing, you know, is co-laboring with Christ, which like the New Testament tells us to do about a dozen times. And the idea is we're supposed to be involved in things that are bigger than we are, the big deep waters that, you know, truly, if God doesn't show up, we're sunk. But, you know, again, I genuinely believe those things that we believe, you know, as believers. And one thing I find, you know, the analogy of Peter being invited to come out of the boat and walk on the stormy water to Jesus. Well, you look at Jesus, your eyes are there, you do okay. But if you choose to look at the stormy waters, you sink rather instantly. I mean, I'm not more than 15 minutes from sinking on any given day if my attention is on the wrong thing.
Yeah,
so, you know, I don't let zeitgeist and media drive me. And that's an important thing for all our members, I think, you know, regardless of what the subject is. But yeah, God's moving on this, and we are going to win it. The thing is, we want to win it sooner rather than later, is because we're fighting for the lives and health of kids.
It's justice. It's justice that we are fighting for. Why aren't more Christian healthcare professionals getting involved in standing up for a position that we've provided, with your wonderful help and others, a great transgender identity position statement? Is it an issue of busyness? Is it perceived lack of expertise? Is it fear because of those waves walking on the water you were talking about? Is it maybe even disagreement with a CMDA perspective? What do you think?
Yeah, kind of all of the above. You know, time's a precious commodity, so time commitment is a sacrifice. It's true. There's no way around it. Perceived lack of expertise is a big thing for doctors. You know, we're trained to be experts. So it's a hindrance to our extracurricular endeavors. And that holds true from evangelism right on down. But the thing is, that can be overcome by, you know, time on task and getting in the fight with good teams. I mean, teams are what help make this possible. Fear, yeah, that's real. And, you know, you have reasons to be fear. I mean, I've told legislatures that there is the genuine risk, this is why they don't have more people testifying, the genuine risk of losing our reputation, our jobs, our career, our personal safety, and maybe that of our families. But again, you know, this is about protecting minors and justice. So yeah, it's kind of worth it, right? Even if it ends up costing us. Disagreement with CMDA. Well, you know, that comes easily if you're just listening to the zeitgeist and the sales pitches, which are designed to be winsome and emotion provoking, but they're also wrong. And time's going to show that to be the case.
How would you recommend those listening today get started in getting involved? And is it, do you think there's some truth? Wow, Andre, I've never seen a patient, whether adult or adolescent or child, with gender dysphoria. How could I possibly get engaged in this discussion? How would you respond to that?
You know, we don't even necessarily have to be treating gender dysphoric patients. You know, there's the public voice, all kinds of other ways to be involved, you know, letters to the editor, supporting organizations that help. There's a good many things. But a few points I thought of here, you know, scripture instructs us to value and apply ourselves strongly to knowledge, insight, and wisdom. And that takes sweat equity, right? So one is to get informed. Secondly, call upon the Lord for that same guidance, wisdom, and insight. He asks us to do it. It's a real simple two-part prayer in terms of when you are interacting with people that I learned from a pastor in the San Francisco area. And he says it's this. Point one, Lord, is this person teachable? Point two, what would you have me say to them? And I find myself breathing that one a lot. People value stories, even if they say they don't. That's why parables work so well. They're relatable stories. And there's all kinds of life stories out there, like Walt Hyers and numerous others, you know, available on Christian website, conservative websites, et cetera. And, you know, many of these people with regret aren't Christians, aren't conservatives. It's very much a hands across the aisle effort. Learn some of those life stories of those who have desisted with regret because of what they had already done, and others who went full bore and are detransitioning. Just get to know a few of those to be able to communicate it. And finally, I'd say put your limited time where it's going to do the most good, rather than getting bogged down in that troll gauntlet of social media. I have some friends that love, you know, getting involved in social media. I just find it tiresome and, you know, not that productive. Three quotes here are good. One from writer Mark Stein: the future belongs to those who show up. You know, it's so simple, it sounds funny, but it's true. Havilah Cunnington, who's a churchmate of mine, says we succeed by outlasting the crowd. You may not look good, you know, muddy, bruised, bloody, but last person standing wins. And third is Britain's pastor Ade Omuba, who says to simply stand is to win. Be doing the right thing, be a presence, and that in itself is a victory.
Well, I want our listeners to know that we do have some resources at CMDA. You can go to cmda.org/ethics, and you'll find about 90 position statements, including the one on transgender identity. And we're going to try to keep that as up to date as we can with the help of folks like Andre and colleagues who are, as you've heard, globetrotting, sharing about truth and unfortunately speaking to a minority, both in Europe and the U.S. But it seems like God's people have usually been in the minority, have we not, Andre?
Yeah, apparently that's how it works. I'm sad to say it's not the big crowds. It's surprisingly few.
Andre, I want to thank you for joining me today, and God bless you, and pass our appreciation to your wife, who lets you be so intensely involved in fighting this battle.
Thank you much.
Well, this conversation with Dr. Van Maal only further convinces me that the transgender debate is truly the issue of our generation. And like Andre said, we are called as Christians to wade into the deep, stormy waters of this controversy, to advocate for biblical justice for our children and the next generations to come. Well, here at CMDA headquarters, we hear over and over again that people are in need of resources specifically related to the transgender topic. So we've developed quite a list of books and podcasts, blog posts, continuing education materials, and much more to help you navigate these challenges. I want to share a select few of those materials with you. First, during our discussion, you heard Andre mention a handful of journal articles and other academic literature that can be extremely beneficial to our members. You'll find a list of those in our show notes today to make it easier for you to gain access to them. Andre is also a prolific writer on this topic, and he's a regular contributor to CMDA's Point blog, which is a weekly blog that shares perspectives and opinions on today's important healthcare topics. He's written about the closing of that Tavistock Gender Clinic in the United Kingdom, which we just talked about a few minutes ago. He's written about patients who regret transitioning. He's written about the false science behind this movement and so much more. You can find his blogs and a variety of others online at cmda.org/thepoint. Next, I want to encourage you to check out our CMDA Learning Center. There are a handful of courses available right now for continuing education credit that discuss the transgender topic. For example, you can find recordings from a conference that we hosted last fall with the Hendricks Center at Dallas Theological Seminary, which we titled Critical Conversations on Identity and Gender. Plus, you can find other webinars that discuss the misnamed conversion therapy topic, the biblical, theological, and clinical perspectives of the transgender movement, and several others. All of these courses are free to our CMDA members. and I also encourage you to share them with your colleagues. You can find these courses and more in the CMDA Learning Center by going to cmda.org/learning. Plus, there are a few books in our CMDA bookstore that I know will prove helpful to you. First, you've heard us talk about on this podcast many times, is the book When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Debate. Drawing on great insights from biology, psychology, and philosophy, author Ryan T. Anderson offers us a balanced approach to these policy issues, as well as a nuanced vision of human embodiment and a sober, as well as honest survey of the human costs of getting human nature wrong. He reveals a grim contrast between the media's sunny depiction and the often sad realities of gender identity struggles. He introduces readers to people who tried to transition, but found themselves no better off, in fact, worse. Especially troubling is the suffering felt by adults who were encouraged to transition as children, but later came to regret it. And there's a reason that many do regret it. As Anderson writes, the most helpful therapies focus not on achieving the impossible, which is changing bodies to conform to thoughts and feelings, but on helping people accept and even embrace the truth about their bodies and reality. This discussion will be of particular interest to parents who fear how an ideological school counselor might just try to steer their child the wrong way. The second book is entitled God and the Transgender Debate by Andrew T. Walker, which helps Christians understand what the Bible actually says about gender identity. This book will help you to engage lovingly, thoughtfully, and faithfully with one of the most explosive cultural discussions of our day. It also includes a section looking at practical questions that include, can someone be transgender as well as Christian? Should I mind if people who are biologically the other sex are in my restroom? What should church leaders do if a congregation member asks for their child to be identified as the opposite gender? If you want to learn more and love better and are open to considering what God has to say about sex and gender, this hope-filled book is for you. You can find both of these books and many others in the CMDA bookstore by going to cmda.org/bookstore. CMDA's Freedom to Care website has started creating a central hub of the latest news as well as resources for healthcare professionals related to all these gender issues. You can find fact sheets, ethics statements, and more by going to Freedom to Care, that's the word freedom, the numeral 2, care.org. Speaking of position statements, if you haven't already checked out CMDA's ethics statements, I want to encourage you to do so now. These statements are designed to provide you with biblical, ethical, social, and scientific understanding of a variety of bioethical issues through concise statements articulated in a most compassionate and caring manner. CMDA's Ethics Committee spends countless hours researching and crafting these statements because we place so much value on providing these as resources for our members. Included in a long list of statements are statements specifically addressing transgender identification, homosexuality, conscience rights, and many more. These statements can be found at cmda.org/ethics. And if you want to follow in Andre's bold and courageous footsteps and engage with this issue in your own state's legislature, or help testify to support bills like Save Adolescents from Experimentation, acronym SAFE Acts, then I hope you'll take the time to connect with CMDA's advocacy and communications team. It's the beginning right now of a new legislative season, so right now is the time to get involved. Contact advocacy at cmda.org for more information. One final announcement for you before we close out this week's episode. Registration is now open for our next webinar with the Hendricks Center and Dallas Theological Seminary. That'll be on Saturday, February 4th at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. This webinar is entitled Critical Conversations on Pregnancy After Roe. This webinar is designed to help explore the daunting task that healthcare professionals as well as pastoral care professionals face amid discussions about complicated pregnancies in a post-Roe America. How do we speak effectively, truthfully, and graciously while giving meaningful care in such an environment? Join us for this critical conversation as we consider the theological, medical, legal, and pastoral perspectives required to serve our patients well. This webinar is free to CMDA members, so register now by going to cmda.org/events. Please join me next week as Pastor Burt Jones and I will be talking with two of our life and leadership coaching faculty about the coach approach to mentoring. You don't want to miss it. I want to end this week's episode with a comment that we recently received from a CMDA member in Texas who said, "It's so good to have people who believe the same and who recognize that this transgender movement is not grounded in medicine." Well, just like Dr. Van Maal shared with us, the community of CMDA is called to co-labor with Christ in our daily work as we communicate patience, love, and truth to our patients, those who are struggling with gender dysphoria, as well as sharing that love and truth with their parents. My prayer today, friends, is that through CMDA, you will be educated, encouraged, and equipped to meet your patients right where they are in the midst of their gender identity struggles, and that you will be educated, encouraged, and equipped to bring the hope and healing of Christ to them and to our world. That's what matters to CMDA, friends, and CMDA matters more than ever. We'll see you next week, God willing.
This podcast has been a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.